When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
My name is Kathleen Stock. I'm a professor of philosophy at the University of Sussex, and I write publicly about sex and gender and feminism and sexual orientation. I've just written a book called Material Girls: Why Reality Matters for Feminism.
I'm Colette Colfer. In this episode, I speak to Kathleen Stock, who has just given a wonderful introduction to herself, so I don't think there's any need for me to say anything else about it. I'm here in County Wicklow, and there's just been a July downpour.
Delete that in. Come on.
Downpour. And there's just one thing I want to mention before we go into the interview. And that is, during the interview, I mentioned that in the book, Kathleen Stock talks about the four axioms of what I described, the four axioms of modern trans activism, which she examines from different angles in the book. I just want to go through them very briefly. Number one is that you and I and everyone else have an important inner state called a gender identity. Number two, for some people, inner gender identity fails to match the biological sex, male or female, originally assigned to them at birth by medics. These are trans people. Number three, gender identity, not biological sex, is what makes you a man or a woman or neither.
What does that mean, or neither?
You could be non-binary, so that you don't identify as being either a man or a woman. And number four, the existence of trans people generates a moral obligation upon all of us to recognise and legally to protect gender identity and not biological sex. So with that, we'll flick to the interview. And I started by asking Kathleen, why did she write the book?
I wrote this book because I thought I could contribute to the discussion and I had something to bring. So the discussion is between what people call trans rights, although sometimes I think what's claimed under that heading isn't really about rights at all, and feminism. And there's obviously a big toxic, debate, what do you call it, war, row going on. And I'm a philosopher, so a lot of the intellectual background that's used by trans activists refers to philosophical context and concepts. And I thought I could help by sort of putting my own opinionated take on things and trying to clarify some issues like the way gender is used, this word gender that means like four different things at least. So that's why I wrote it, really. I mean, on a personal level, I've been writing about this in public for about 3 years. And so I've been writing blog posts and bits and pieces for various magazines and things like that. But this is like my best attempt to lay it all out, you know, at length, clearly.
It's a great book, and I think it's really important for anybody who's kind of delving into the area and who wants to know. I mean, some of the things that I think you do brilliantly in it are, you know, looking at the axioms of gender identity theory, which mm-hmm. just sets it out really nice and clearly. You know, this is exactly what it means. And people can read it for themselves. I don't want to go too much into that. And also mm-hmm. The different ways the term gender is used. So you can have somebody in a conversation using the term gender, applying to a few different concepts. So it becomes mm-hmm. really complicated.
Yeah.
But I want to go back a little bit then. So you said about 3 years ago, you started writing about these issues.
Mm-hmm.
What was it that initially
pushed
got
you over the edge?
Yeah. Pushed you over the edge, got you into looking at this issue.
Well, I'm lesbian. So I was already aware that there were trans women on dating apps when I was dating. And, you know, I mean, I don't mean sort of what you might call passing trans women. I mean, people that clearly looked male, yet were calling themselves lesbian and were on my dating app coming up with suggestions for me. So I knew that there was some kind of mixing going on of concepts here, you know, because I'm a lesbian, I'm attracted to females. So doesn't include trans women. And that's not an insult to trans women. That's just a kind of statement of my orientation. So I knew about it. And then I also, in my professional life, I'm an academic. And as you no doubt know, universities mostly are at the forefront of whatever radical politics is sweeping the nation. And so everything's about self-ID at my university. I saw a menopause group the other day open to anyone who identifies as a woman. Any event about the gender pay gap is open to anyone who identifies as a woman. You know, so and in philosophy, like the Society for Women in Philosophy, which is supposed to represent women, and there aren't that many women in philosophy, is open to anyone who identifies as a woman. So that was already irritating me, to be honest, quite a lot, because I think in all those areas, these are things that the gender pay gap, the menopause, and you know, being a woman in philosophy, those are things that happen to females. So I thought it was really unhelpful to mix all that up. And I started to, and then the thing that pushed me over the edge, I suppose, is just seeing how women who were trying to talk about this were treated. Like I started looking at Women's Place UK, which is a grassroots organization set up to allow women to be able to talk about these changes in policy and law that affect them. And they were having bomb threats and just this huge monstering of their reputations and their characters going on. And then in philosophy, no one was sticking up for them. And in fact, lots of people joining in. It just really enraged me. It's not what I went into academia for. So I just decided one day to I wrote a blog post, press send, went for a walk, came back, saw that I was being denounced. And that's how it started.
Really?
Was it? Yeah.
Wow. So it was in the course of one day, you just kind of said all of these things.
Yeah. Well, I asked a question. I wrote a blog post and put it on Medium, which is like a self-publishing platform. I didn't have many followers or anything like that, and I just said, why is academic philosophy ignoring questions about gender recognition reform? Because, you know, normally academic philosophers will argue about anything with you. Like, they'll argue about euthanasia, about abortion, about all these so really controversial areas, and they can take quite extreme positions and nobody seems to mind. But we were at the time in the UK being publicly consulted by the government about our views, like as a nation, and yet I didn't see any academics criticizing the plans to move to self-ID that were in the mix at the time. I saw lots of people applauding them, but I didn't see anyone criticizing them, and I thought that was a gap, and I was curious so why. Well, I mean, I kind of knew why, to be honest, because everyone's frightened, basically.
Right, so your initial blog was centered around a question then. Why aren't people discussing this?
Why aren't people discussing it? And then I also said, we're going to have to ask the question, are trans women women? Because you can't not ask that question. And it is a philosophical question. Like, ask, what is a woman? And, you know, again, we're supposed to be talking about definitions all the time in philosophy. So I asked the question about that. And you see, even to ask that question was obviously a red rag to a bull for many people in philosophy. They just, you can't even ask that question. And at the time, I actually didn't know what the answer was, because I knew that trans women weren't female, but there is a view in philosophy, which I discuss in my book, that being a woman is not the same as being female. And I wanted to think about that before I kind of came out and said what I thought. So it took me about a year, I think, to work out what I thought about that. But so I didn't, at that point, I was quite careful. I kept talking about females and not women. But you're not even allowed to talk about females. That became clear quite obvious. That became clear quite early on, that you're not even allowed to say that trans women are male-bodied people. People were like, oh God, she's saying male-bodied. That's just such a dog whistle or whatever.
It is the idea that they have a female penis, isn't it? That's kind of the thing these days.
Well, it's a sort of logical extension. If you're not allowed to say that they have male bodies, then...
the penis becomes female.
Exactly. The penis is no longer male. And then what is it? Well, I mean, I've seen some crazy circular reasoning. You know, I have a female penis because I am a female. Well, you're not, you know, unfortunately, you're not a female and you don't have a female penis, because there's no such thing.
Right. So when you brought out this blog, which I probably read, you know, you read so much, I think once start to delve into these issues, it's kind of mind boggling, and it's hard to let go of it when you realise what's actually going on, I think. I know that's what happened to me, that it's just, the more you read and see what's going on, it's kind of incredible. And for me, it's like, I can't understand why other people can't see what's going on. And I do understand there's a huge amount of fear. But for you, you wrote this blog. Were you afraid?
Not immediately, although I did realise that I was going to get a lot of flack, but I didn't realise how much flack I would get. I think I was naive, to be honest. So no, initially I just thought, I think I was really naive, because I thought, okay, I'll get some arguments. But basically, once I draw people's attention, especially in academic philosophy, to this issue, then they'll start arguing about it. And then it'll be business as usual, and they'll get involved and start speaking up. And I thought I was drawing attention to an issue that philosophers were not aware of, that they would then feel compelled to get involved in, because I knew that not everybody thought that gender identity was more important than sex. That would be really unusual for everyone in philosophy to feel the same way about that. But no, that's not what happened. It is sort of happening a bit more now, 3 years later, gradually, one by one, some philosophers are sort of popping up to start talking about this, but it's taken a long time. And initially, they just, the most that they felt they could do, the ones that were supportive of me, was to say that I should have the right to say what I was saying. So that's a kind of fallback position. Like, they don't actually want to pronounce on the issue of whether trans women are women or whether gender identity is more important than sex, but they do want to stand up for my right to say or to ask questions about that. So that's nice. That's good of them. I do appreciate it.
Did you get any support originally from other philosophers in academia?
Well, yeah, I got support for my right to speak. But no.
Not even one?
Oh, no, yeah, sorry. There's a handful of very intrepid women philosophers. Mary Leng is one at the University of York. Sophie Allen, who's at the University of Kiel, Holly Lawford-Smith, who's at the University of Melbourne, and there are a couple of others too, and they, this is from within universities, they have tried to argue about this and are trying to publish papers, and, you know, so we form a little gang.
Great. How bad did it get for you? What was the worst things that happened?
Well, I mean, it's been a long... You know, it's been 3 years, and I don't know if I've got sort of a top 10 of terrible things, but you know, I've had a lot of, I've been no platformed. So that is, I've been invited, I suppose deplatformed is the right word, because I get invited to things and then there's huge protest and then the invitation is withdrawn. I've had harassment, you know, on campus. I've had protests on campus, stickers on my door saying I'm a TERF. I've had people send me stuff in the post that's not particularly great. I've had a lot of hostility from colleagues, like professional colleagues, adults at my own institution online, saying, you know, defaming me, saying I'm a danger to trans students, which is not true at all. And actually, some trans people agree with me, some people disagree with me, but I teach trans students professionally and normally. I'm trying to think. I mean, it's just a sort of relentless hostility from quite a small number of people, relatively speaking. But, you know, over time, it can get really exhausting, particularly because you feel so alone, because there's nobody that other people see what's happening to you. And then they don't want to say that they support you in case the kind of the outrage machine wheels around and starts to target them. So it's the isolation combined with the harassment that is psychologically tiring at times. Yeah.
That's a good phrase, the outrage machine. You know, then, like, do you ever just feel like, oh, I've had enough of this? I don't want to talk about this anymore.
Yeah, but actually, I'm talking about my book now with you, and I've done some other stuff, but I actually genuinely don't want to talk about this anymore, in the sense that I've written the book now that says everything I want to say. And I don't think, I mean, although I'm always open to changing my mind as a philosopher, that's part of my job, I really don't think I'm going to change my mind on this stuff, because it's so obvious that, to me, that there are two sexes, that people cannot change sex, that, you know, it's a fiction that trans women are women and that trans men are men. And it may be a fiction that we go along with in some context, benevolently, for good reasons, but it's not literally true. So I know this now. I also know that lesbians are people, females attracted to females, you know, nothing's going to change my mind about that. So I want to move on to more interesting things, because it's not hard to come up with these arguments intellectually. It's hard psychologically, because you face so much flack for doing it, but it's not like the biggest challenge to establish that there's two sexes.
And what has the reception? The book is out now about 2 months, is it? Came out in May 2021. Mm-hmm. So what has the reception been like?
It's been great. I've been really pleased with the reviews. It's not going to please everybody, but, you know, in the mainstream, I wrote it for the mainstream. You know, I wrote it for people who are not already convinced, maybe who've seen the row and really are not sure where to go or what to think about it. So I wanted to provide a kind of reassuring guide, you know, that is clearly not bigoted and not transphobic, but is also prepared to articulate some perhaps uncomfortable realities responsibly. So that's what I tried to do. Now, that means that for some people, I'm outrageous, and I'm saying things that they really don't want to hear and they don't want anyone else to hear. And for some other people within the feminist movement, I am far too timid and not radical enough and a bit of a collaborator and a capitulator and all that. So I get flack on both sides. That's fine. That's probably expected given where I'm pitching it and what the book says. So I'm happy with what I said. It's what I think.
In the first few weeks, it went into the charts. How's it doing at the moment?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think it's...
It was in the top 10 in the first week, wasn't it?
It was 11. Okay, it was a hardback nonfiction. It was number 11. It was just outside the top 10 the first week, which was amazing, absolutely amazing. For a book on, like, popular philosophy, I was really proud of that. And it's been up and down the Amazon charts. I don't know. I think it's like 2000 or something now. Right. It's going to be released in America in September. Ooh. So at the moment, it's just Britain, right. I think.
And has the heat on you increased since the book has come out, or is it really get much worse?
No, I mean, it's not noticeably. Things happen and then they pass, you know. So there's a couple of things going on at the moment. There's a couple of attempts to. So I've joined an editorial board of a new journal, a new philosophy journal. I actually was invited for my work on fiction, and there's attempts to get me removed from that board. You know, I'm contributing an article to another journal, and there's been an attempt to stop that happening. But you know, these things sort of bubble up and then they disappear and then they bubble up. And I've got a lot thicker skin these days, so I really don't take it massively personally.
And are these journals anymore. Academic journals that have anything to do with gender necessarily?
No.
Right. But they still
no. They
don't
just want to have
you.
No. I mean, that's the level we're dealing with. That by certain people, I am designated, you know, unclean. Doesn't matter what I do. So I've had protests against papers that aren't anything to do with trans. People just don't want me around because they say I make them feel uncomfortable or unsafe, which is nonsense. And actually, in January there was an open letter written against me signed by lots and lots of philosophers, and it became clear in the content of this letter, which made all these defamatory claims about me, like outrageous claims about me, but they made specific claim about what I think that was false and demonstrably false. So in other words, they don't even know what I think. I'd be very surprised if my most vocal critics were actually reading my book, because they don't want to know. They just want to stay with the caricature of the horrible person that they've got, and they don't want to update it in terms of real-time information, because that would be embarrassing for them, I assume. So, yeah, there will be people that go to their graves thinking that I am the world's worst, but I can live with that.
Yeah. It makes sense that they don't want to read your book. I mean, the argument that you have of being immersed in a fiction, if they read the book, it might... That's kind of one of the main contributions I think your book is making, isn't it, to the discourse on gender, this idea of being immersed in a fiction. But if they read the book, then the fiction, they'd have to kind of acknowledge that. Okay,
yeah,
and I think that's
Well, sorry, go on.
No, well, that's where the challenge is, because people don't want that fiction.
Yeah,
that realization.
I think that's true. And I actually address that in the book, that the thing about being immersed in a fiction, and of course we do this all the time, it's a perfectly normal part of human life. We have this capacity to lose ourselves in dramas or novels or films or role plays or gaming. You know, some people spend hours every day, me included, actually, because I read a lot of fiction. But you don't, when you're in that world, imaginary world or fictional world, you don't want to be reminded that it's just a fiction, because that kind of ruins the whole immersion. That's just that's an artifact of lots of engagement with fiction. And I do think that that's playing a role here in why there's so much thought suppression or speech suppression, attempted thought suppression, control of language, shutting down of argument, shutting down of raising questions, because they start to expose the internal contradictions in the whole scenario, and that starts to draw attention to the fact it's not really true. Now, I don't want your listeners to misunderstand me, because I'm not saying it's delusional. I'm not saying it's there's anything wrong with it, even, because, like I say, I think actually being immersed in fiction can be a really valuable part of life. It allows you to explore new perspectives and, you know, protect yourself in some ways from really difficult psychological events, but it has its limits. And the trouble is, at the moment, we're being compelled in the UK to go along with a fiction. You know, we have to put, in some organisations, you have to put your pronouns in your email, even if you've got no idea what that means. You have to observe the preferred pronouns even of male rapists in female prisons. You know, it's just got out of control, this whole apparatus. So we need to inject some reality back in the right contexts.
Yeah, I mean, in the subtitle for the book, you have that word reality, we have gone so far away from it. Mm. Like, language has become the be-all and end-all in a way, this idea of, mm-hmm. and that we're socially constructed. It was, God, I can't remember what book it was I was reading recently, but it was very interesting in that it was saying that the move to culture and the focus on culture was connected to World War II and the development, you know, of Darwinianism and eugenics, so that biology became a kind of a bad thing, the focus on evolution, because then it led to eugenics and to genocide. So the focus then switched to culture was what was considered to be more important then. And that made sense to me.
Well, I mean, I'm not a historian, but what I could say is I think that we all have this very vexed relationship between what is the case and what ought to be the case. As in philosophy, we call it the ought is relationship. What you describe as the facts about the world and then what you prescribe as what should be happening. And I think you can go too far in the opposite direction. You can think that facts about biology just on their own tell you what you should be doing. And that's clearly present in some anti-feminism, which sees the fact that women can have children as kind of showing that they should be having children, or they should be at home, or they should be, out of the workplace. So that's, and actually really annoyingly, our critics, my critics would say that that's my position. That's clearly not my position. I'm not giving biology anything like that sort of importance in determining what should be the case. But you can go too far in the other direction and just completely deny the facts of biology. Think that, it's totally hubristic. And it's just kind of rationalism gone mad to think that we can make up the world through our thoughts, even collectively or individually. So we've got to, as in all things, find a balance, find the mean, as Aristotle would say, between the two extremes. and that's why, in a way, that's what I'm trying to do in the book, although I don't put it in those terms.
Yeah. There is it's a basic thing. Biology does matter. But to even say that these days, you can be accused of being transphobic. Mm-hmm. I don't know. It's just, it blows my mind that we've got to this point. And I do find it scary as well, because I've been involved in the debate to a certain extent. I also think Twitter and social media is so inflammatory. And then people see of what they're saying on Twitter. And then you meet them in real life and you have a conversation. Actually, yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah.
It's like two different worlds in a way.
Yeah. Well, yes, because Twitter is the world's worst format for good faith, rational dialogue. Just the fact that the character limit is so small, so you can't really say what you want to very easily. It lends itself to misunderstanding, and the fact things can get retweeted out of context means that readers can just project whatever they imagine you mean onto you, and then others can take that up and it can spiral very quickly. So I've done well out of using Twitter, in the sense that I've got lots of followers and I've managed to draw people's attention to my writing and speaking, but I don't use it. I don't know if anyone's noticed, but I don't really use it for arguing. I don't think it doesn't work for me at all.
Okay. So if somebody says something you don't agree with, you just leave it.
I just ignore it. I mean, there is a room. I do think Twitter users would do well to understand, some of them, that you can ignore things you don't agree with, or even blatant insults,
Yeah. Well, when you have followers, like, how many followers do you have on Twitter? 50,000?
No, I've got 40 something, I think. Yeah. Okay. But yeah, I mean,
So when you have that many people following, there's going to be a lot.
Yeah, there's a lot of argy-bargy. My mentions are quite a mess sometimes, but it just doesn't work for me as a format. And I don't feel, it makes me angry as well. I'm not very fond of accounts that have like one dimensional tone that's either always angry or always snide. I think you can read that, follow lots of those accounts and find yourself getting really into a negative state of mind, maybe like mirror neurons or something firing, but you can get very angry too. And it's not really an a kind of authentic anger. It's just being whipped up by transmission.
The so I try machine and anger.
Yeah, I don't really. I think so. I guess what I'm trying to say is that I think gender critical feminists or radical feminists or people who agree with me on some things should watch out themselves that they don't end up in bubbles, that they don't end up being whipped up by each other into frenzies they wouldn't otherwise be in. You know, we are subject to the same sorts of distorting Twitter effects as trans activists are. And I would like to see more kind of recognition of that, I guess, sometimes. I think there's a real huge defensiveness on our side about, you know, we're always good people and we always mean well. And we, you know, that's not true. There's some real assholes on our side as well.
Yeah, there's a danger, isn't it? It's like, it's so polarized. And when we portray other people as the enemy, well, then it kind of can justify us doing lots of things. It's a very dangerous area to be in.
Exactly.
Now, the thing was, right, I put it up on Facebook, it was, when your book came out, and I said, fantastic, you know, Kathleen Stock's book is out. And somebody who I'd never met in real life actually responded saying, did you not see what she has written about some feminists in the book? And I said, no, I haven't read that. I've just started reading it. And
I criticised other feminists.
Yeah. So some group of feminists are very angry with you.
Yes. Yes, although again, I don't really keep up. Like, I'm not one of these people that's got some kind of Google alert on my name, so I don't know what the latest is. But yeah, I criticize Julia Long is one of them, and I'm sure your listeners who are involved with all this will know that that's what I do. But I mean, it's in two lines of the book. Of again, there's been sort of mortal outrage. My book is also being misrepresented by some feminists. And as you know, I don't mind people disagreeing with me, but actually factually, they're saying I say things I don't say. So I would urge anyone who's read something really critical from the feminist side of things of my book to actually check. You know, fair enough if you still think I'm an asshole and disagree with me afterwards, but it's very annoying to be misrepresented.
So can you explain what is your criticism of Julia Long?
Well, I actually...
Her ideas.
I mean, there's lots of things I disagree with Julia Long about, but the one bit of the book where I talk about an article that she wrote, and she's criticising... excuse me. She's criticising the Women's Place organisation, which is the one I mentioned earlier, for having trans women on the platform. So these were events which took place under enormous hostility. Sometimes they had gender critical trans women on the platform, like Christina Harrison and Debbie Hayton, alongside other women. And they did that, I think, totally sensibly. It was a great strategy because it showed to the public that they were not transphobic, that they were not against. And it's not about women versus trans women. It's about a coalition. And in this article, Julia Long is incredibly snide about the trans women on the platform. And she says that they're bamboozling the audience. You know, she just makes out that the audience of Women's Place meetings are stupid and capitulating and somehow dazzled by trans women in a way that's, I don't know, not feminist, and that Women's Place should not have platformed them there. And I just said, that's, you know, I expressed strong disagreement with that in that section.
Right.
And then after that, you know, Julia, I believe, did a whole hour's worth of ranting about my book with Posy Parker and has written a critical review of it. And various others have written stuff too. And it's all spiraled out of control now. So now apparently I'm, you know, the claim is that I'm being really exclusionary of trans widows. That is the colloquial term for women married to late transitioning trans women whose marriages end. And of course, right, I'm not being exclusionary to trans widows. And there's actually other parts of the book where I'm very vocal in defense of them. And that point had nothing to do with trans widows as far as I was concerned. But, you know, as outrage builds,
oh my goodness,
and as Twitter bubbles all talk to each other and shout, you know, stories change, morph, and before you know it, my book is really exclusionary about trans widows and various other things that's not true either. So that's an example of our side.
Yeah, I think you make really great point in the book that on one side there is the claim that the other people are being transphobic, and on the other side it's the claim that the other people are being misogynistic. And these terms are just thrown around just so loosely as a way, as far as I'm concerned, it's just a way of silencing. So it gets really destroys the possibility of there being an open, rational debate between two people with different ideas. You know, just once you start using these names, it's just like it's gone down the drain.
I think there's a time and a place to use the words transphobic and misogynist. Definitely. There are people whose active actions clearly, you know, by any standard betray severe hatred of women or hatred of trans people as a group. But the words should not be devalued by being used whenever you want to get your opponent to shut up. And
that's exactly what I mean.
So, and that's the point I try and make in the book too. So I'm actually quite careful to use misogyny where there's always going to be exceptions, and I get angry like everyone else. So I'm sure if you went back in my Twitter back catalogue, you'd find times where I'd probably use misogynist sort of in a weaponized way, but I don't do it, you know, as far as I can help. And I really try and save it for the times when it's obviously applicable. And same for any kind of, like homophobic too, actually. Yes. I don't think,
there's lots of times
homophobia gets chucked around that I don't think are appropriate.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I agree exactly with what you're saying, that these things do exist, but at the same time, the words are used sometimes inappropriately and in a way that cheapens or, you know, takes away from the fact that there are actual, you know, homophobes, transphobes, misogynists out there. Mm-hmm. So the heat comes off of them completely.
Well, exactly.
I
mean, we risk a backlash, actually, I think. These words are just, transphobia in particular, just used so indiscriminately of anyone who's trying to raise questions about things like radical mastectomies of 20-year-olds or, you know, males in women's prisons. If you're using transphobe in that context, then you will lose the capacity to pick out the genuine transphobia. People will get sick of the word. They will just think, oh, it's just being used politically and weaponized. So, you know, so we really need to keep a space for the meaning of that word.
Well, one thing in my Facebook post that I did change slightly from your book, you have Material Girls, Why Reality Matters for Feminism, and I put in brackets, and for everyone.
Yeah, absolutely. It's not just a book for feminists, actually.
Important.
The feminists would say it's not even a book for feminists. But it's because if you think about what's happening, There's a concerted attempt, which just seems to be quite successful in many national institutions are going along with it, this attempt to get rid of talking about sex, to not mention males, females as such, to make things gender neutral, to make language gender neutral, or to prioritize gender identity over sex. Now, that is going to affect nearly everyone, not just women. Obviously, it's going to affect men. It's going to affect religious minorities, for whom having men and women are really important. It's going to affect medicine, it's going to affect sport, as we've seen. There's a thousand contexts in which pointing out that there are males and females and a difference between the two are essential to life, because we are a sexually dimorphic species that reproduce through sexual reproduction. So, and that involves a male and a female. No, you can't get away from it. So that means that if we lose the words to be able to describe that, we all lose, including trans people. You know, you can't explain why someone's trans if you can't say what their sex is.
Mm, yeah. Yeah, it has implications for everyone. And another point that you make in the book that I was like, yes, yes, is is that it's a generational divide as well. Like massively so, I would say. Like kids today who are in their teens have grown up with this idea that everybody has a gender identity and that people are who they say they are. And I think what's really interesting is that in parallel with the move towards a gender identity is that there's been the Me Too movement. And yeah, and people don't, you know, who might be saying hashtag Me Too, I've been sexually assaulted or sexually abused in a situation with a stranger, you know, at the same time then are saying I accept anybody to be who they say they are according to their gender identity. So there's kind of a contradiction there.
Oh, yeah, there's a lot of contradictions in this whole thing. I mean, that one is amazing to me. Absolutely amazing. And that you can move from a movement that's absolutely a sort of popular movement, Me Too movement, which is predicated on the idea of males aggressing females sexually, not all of them, but, you know, most of us have a story. Or at least one, and then move from that almost seamlessly to some kind of elaborate self-abnegation where so-called feminists now say, you know, of course trans women should be in the spaces where we undress and sleep, as if something magical happens to people when they put on a dress, you know. It just doesn't. People are thinking magically. What was there before will be there afterwards. and it's not a character reference, as I keep saying. It's not a character reference for the male sex to say that women should have spaces where they are protected, because that's safeguarding. It excludes the few, you know, excludes everyone in order to protect from the few aggressors. So it's bonkers. I can't explain it except to say that maybe it's about part of a backlash in some way. The pendulum swung back almost instantly.
Yeah. Do you think it has got to do religion too as well? Like,
I think there's a sort of religious archetypes involved, you know, in the sense, I don't mean of like signing you up to any particular faith, but within religion, there are sort of recurring motifs like redemption, rebirth, transformation, metamorphosis, transubstantiation, you know, all of those things. Now many of us are atheists these days. We have more secular society, but the power of those archetypes doesn't disappear. It just reemerges in different ways now. So dualism is another one. The idea that the soul is separate from the body, you know, the modern version of that is your gender identity. You've got a gendered soul that's distinct from the sexed body. So I think it's fascinating, that aspect of this, that quite a lot of it is incredibly familiar from other cultural discourses, but it's just painted in new ways and people don't even notice the kind of religious aspect. The mantras, the priests, the holy days, like Holy Week, Pride Week, you know, all the different, when you start thinking about all the parallels, we've got a new religion. I don't have it. I'm still an atheist, but...
Yeah. It is the human need, I think, and that we think of ourselves, humans, I mean, you know, as being so rational and scientific and we need evidence for this. And then we fall into these things.
Yeah.
I mean, I could be falling into these things and not realize that I am, because because we don't know that we are when we are.
Yeah.
But I think it's like there's a space that has been left by the vacation of institutional religion, maybe.
I totally agree. I think that's obviously true. Never have I seen such... I mean, you talked about the generational gap, but this generation of teenagers and 20-somethings, many of them are so concerned with doing the right thing, so moral, in some sense of moral. You know, I'm not saying they're good at right 100%, but, you know, they really think about every aspect of their life. They want to control every aspect of their life. They feel huge guilt and shame when they think they've messed up. These are all old emotions that the Catholic Church used to, I'm a Catholic, you know, used to you know, produce in people, and now people are producing for themselves.
I wish I could just acknowledge the people who say these things, because it's not my idea, but this idea of there being, I think it might have been Benjamin Boyce who said it at one point, talking about the idea of original sin.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that with, and I come from a Catholic background too, but we're born with this idea that we have an original sin, that there's something that we have inside of us that's bad. Whereas now we don't have that. So our young people growing up today, so there's the idea that they can aspire to being perfect, morally perfect. There is no.
Although I do, I mean, that sounds interesting, but I also think that they, from observation, and I should say us, you know, I'm not immune to any of these things myself, but, you know, there's a sense, I think, of guilt there too. They don't really believe they can be perfect. I think that there's a lot of shame, particularly for women. I mean, a lot of it will be culturally produced as well. It's not coming. These things are not happening in a vacuum. They're part of our zeitgeist, and they're part of a cultural moment, and they're produced by things like Instagram and TikTok, and there'll be all sorts of cultural forces producing all this. So I don't want to suggest that it's anyone's fault that this is happening. It's just it's just where we are.
Multiple factors that go into it.
Yeah.
I actually think feminism is one of the contributory factors that has brought us to here. You know,
in what way?
That, you know, you talk about John Money and Robert Stoller in your book. And mm-hmm. so it was connected to the intersex, the treatment of intersex children. Mm-hmm. And that's where kind of the first time the phrase gender role is used in gender identity. But that feminists in the 60s and 70s really just hooked onto this idea of gender. So that it's not biology that means that women are treated the way they are. We're treated this way because of culture.
Yes, and it's that word "because" is important, because, you know, causal. There can be many causal influences resulting in a particular effect. So women's disadvantage, structural disadvantage, can be partly to do with culture and partly to do with culture hooking onto biological aspects of women's existence, like pregnancy, for instance, being the obvious one. So feminists in the 70s, as I say in the book, they just, some of them anyway, really wanted to get away from the idea that we're determined in particular directions by our biology, so that we ought to be at home looking after children because we have wombs. Fair enough. but some of them thought that the way to do this was to deny that womanhood was anything to do with biology. So anatomy is not destiny, they would say. So, I mean, anatomy isn't destiny in some ways, but anatomy has a role to play in one's destiny most of the time. So there'll be other things that have a role to play too. And this degree of nuance just didn't seem there in the kind of most prominent social constructionist accounts. So I think I agree with you that wasn't feminists' finest hour. And these were academic feminists as well. I mean, these, like, people like Catherine MacKinnon.
Yeah, I mean, I can understand where they're coming from, and they wanted to change the situation as it was at the time. And of course, little did they think that it would bring us to this point. But who could have predicted that we could get to this point? I don't know.
No, it's true. You'd have had to have quite a lot of foresight to see precisely how this idea that womanhood is divorced from biology would be weaponized in the directions it's been used by trans activism. But I still think you could have seen that there would be problems once you remove biology from the grounds of feminism, because there's so many things that happen to women partly as a result of their physical state that you can no longer really talk about. So, you know, feminism has not been very good about talking, like, academic feminism has not been good about talking about motherhood, for instance. I also think partly because a lot of academic feminists, like, have children late, or when they do have children, their career is more important. You know, there's sort of sociological reasons why. But they're not, academic feminists are not really good at talking about what most women want to talk about and what matters to them, I think.
Which is?
Well, things like motherhood, which is still really important to loads and loads of women who might not call themselves feminists, but that's okay, you know. There's a sort of real taboo about prioritizing motherhood politically. It's seen as exclusionary of those people that can't have children, for instance, and, you know, all sorts of stuff comes up. But I think mothers should be represented in feminism properly and their interests.
Hear, hear. I absolutely agree. And that would tie in with the body as well. And we can negate the importance of the body, but the body is still going to be important whether we acknowledge it or not. Mm-hmm. It just is.
Of course.
You use that word there, exclusionary. That's just like the another big thing that's going on these days. It's exclusionary. You know, everything has to be inclusion, diversity,
mm-hmm.
and what's equality.
Mm-hmm. Well,
so,
I mean, yeah.
Yeah. So
all of those words are sort of
great ideas.
Sound nice when you don't, but nobody really knows what the hell they mean in practice.
Right. I was interested too in your discussion of intersectionality. I'm not a fan of intersectionality, but you have a very more nuanced view on it. And you think there are positive aspects that we can take from it.
Yeah. I think intersectionality has got a bad rap, although I do understand why. Partly because, you know, as ideas go out into popular culture, they tend to get simplified and reduced, and often to a point where they're no longer really fit for purpose. And I think that's probably happened with the popular conception of intersectionality. And also it's been weaponized, as we've just described with other concepts. So, you know, there are people on the so-called feminist side of the fence who will use intersectionality as some kind of, I don't know what you'd call it, like squash ladder or something, like, you know, mentally ranking different identity groups in terms of oppression, and then anyone who's higher up as a group in comparison to lower groups has no political platform or should be silenced, you know, which is just not a nuanced way to think about huge numbers of people whose circumstances might all be very different. But in theory, and the way that I understand it from people like Crenshaw, Kimberly Crenshaw, is that it just points out that sometimes when you fall under more than one heading, as it were, more than one group, women and you're Black, for instance, there may be disadvantages that you face that face disadvantages because you're a woman, and you face disadvantages because you're Black, and they may be more than the sum of their parts, particularly when you put that into social structures which cannot really conceive of these things as interacting, so tend to look at you one-dimensionally. So I think she's got really interesting things to say, and she gives lots and lots of cases, like concrete cases where this has been the case in American law for Black women, for instance. But Crenshaw says that the fact she's pointing all this out does not mean that there is no such thing as the interests of women as a group. And she also points out that no one makes the moves against anti-racism that they make against feminism in this respect. So, in other words, you can make generalizations about Black people that don't apply to all all Black people without somehow the category collapsing. But feminism seems to think, some feminists, not me, not my kind, seem to think that as soon as you start talking about women, and you can find women where there are exceptions to what you're saying, that somehow that shows that women are not a political group. So I don't know, that's probably a bit complicated for anyone that hasn't read that bit of the book. But the headline is, I think there's lots of interesting stuff in intersectionality. It's just getting misunderstood.
Mm. No, I do agree that there is an interesting aspect to it. Mm-hmm. My problem with it is the focus on oppression and privilege and oppression and privilege. Yeah. And I think that that's, and I think you do actually mention that as well about privilege in the
Well,
book.
I'm not a fan of the concept of privilege either when it's used as the mere absence of disadvantage. I think that's too binary, and the absence of disadvantage is not in itself a privilege, and that move, I think. So, I want to write something one day about that. That's on my list of things to do.
Oh, great.
But it's certainly contributing to the toxicity of this kind of whole screaming match.
Yeah. I should probably think about wrapping it up here now. So
okay.
I want to ask you, I mean, I was just looking, even in the last few weeks, all of the things that have been happening in the last few weeks, you know, the student in Scotland who was under investigation for saying women have vaginas, the Maya Forstater case, the We Spa, am I pronouncing it right, even in America?
I don't know.
Have you heard about that one?
I've heard about it. I don't know how to pronounce it, but yeah.
And when you put it together on the hashtag, it's Whisper. I think, oh,
there's a chocolate bar.
Cadbury's, yeah, yeah. They don't know what's going on. There's Laurel Hubbard, the trans woman competing in the Olympics, and there's the Stonewall stuff that's happening in the UK. In some ways, I think Ireland's is a little bit behind the UK. Not a little bit, possibly a good bit. I was at... In the college where I work, we were brought to, it was a gendered diversity workshop, and we were told, we were recommended to use pronouns. We were told that puberty blockers are reversible and that they reduce harm. And this is academics being taught things that are incorrect. Yeah. And I had huge alarm bells about that. So I think that that's happening here now. It's probably going to get more that way.
That's still happening in the UK too, though.
Is it? Yeah.
Academia is I think universities will be the last places, perversely, will be amongst the last places for some sense to penetrate in this issue. So yeah, those workshops are still happening in British universities too.
Right.
Unfortunately. Yeah, because it's just very simple, oversimplified. I've seen slides from presentations to Oxford University faculty that have the mermaids gender spectrum with a Barbie doll at one end and Ken at the other and some jelly babies in the middle. That's the kind of level of conceptual sophistication we're dealing with. So yeah, it's horrifying. But there's a lot going on at the moment in Britain, and I think it's the sort of, if you imagine like, or I imagine a kind of massive rock being dumped in the middle of a loch, and the ripples just gradually going outwards to the shore. You know, we are seeing the ripples now in all these areas, in sport, in freedom of expression, in child health, in prisons, you know, and the original rock was gender identity ideology. You know, the idea that gender identity is more important than sex. So people didn't notice the ripples when they were far from the shore. Or they could just say it wasn't happening. But now you can't say it's not happening because Laurel Hubbard is in the Olympics, for instance. So we just have to acknowledge what's going on now.
So what do you think is going to happen in the next few months? Or do you see that there is a change happening now?
I think there's definitely a change because it was so extreme 3 years ago. It was so difficult to get any kind of journalist to write responsibly about it. We were always being called anti-trans, for instance, which is just not true. So there's definitely a change because some aspects of the sort of centrist press and right-wing press, for obvious reasons, are writing about it, not necessarily for good reasons, I think, even, but they're writing about it. So it's happening.
When you say not for good reasons...
Well, I think some right-wing outlets see this as a kind of wedge issue. You know, they're basically laughing because the left brought this on themselves to some extent. The left have gone along with all this. They've suppressed discussion of it. So that leaves an opening for people who don't particularly necessarily care about feminism to suddenly start writing, you know. And I mean, don't get me wrong. I think that's better than nothing, actually, because it still gets the word out there. So, and I've written for some of them myself. But in an ideal world, The Guardian, the BBC, and so on, the New York Times would be talking about this responsibly too. Whereas the BBC at the moment, every 3 days they have on their website some picture of a non-binary teenager with a headline like, "It was so great to find my true self," or something like that, or something about puberty blockers or whatever. So we've got some way to go. Mm. It's patchy, that's what I'm saying.
So you haven't noticed a kind of a sea change in recent weeks? Sometimes I think, you know, it's definitely changing. And then I think, no,
I think it's
not
changing. It's really hard to notice when you're in the middle of it, isn't it? Like, you don't know whether it's just a kind of storm or you just don't know what you're looking at. I think we'll have to have a bit of distance. But the fact that my book has come out with a mainstream publisher and Helen Joyce's book, Trans, is about to come out with a mainstream publisher, and I've read that book. It's fantastic in terms of filling in the factual background of trans activism. So my book's more about the ideas. Her book is about the ideas plus a lot of empirical information about how we got here and what the consequences are, the effects are. So I really think that book is going to make a difference as well. And then, you know, let's just keep going and see where we get.
Yeah, yeah. And the more people speaking, the more debate that we have. I mean, mm-hmm. I think personally, my view is it's communication. It's mm-hmm. open debate and conversation is the key thing here. And if that happens, that, you know, there could be more tolerance on all sides. That's probably a bit idealistic, but
I think so. People need to understand on both sides that the other side aren't necessarily evil. On both sides, you know, I think there's good intentions on both sides and there's lack of understanding on both sides. Now, no one's, you know, we're not going to get a perfect world where we all agree, but we have to live together. So, you know, purists of either side, on either side, will not get the world they want. Unfortunately, maybe, I don't know, but that's just the way it is.
Yeah. Okay, well, thank you so much for speaking to me and best of luck. Continue good luck with the book, which
Thank
I think
you.
Is excellent. And
thanks
I hope lots
so much
of people
for having
it.
Me, Colette. Thank you.
That's it for this episode of Spokes. Thanks for listening. If you did enjoy this episode or got anything from it, please do check out our other episodes. And don't forget to like and subscribe and maybe throw down a review or give us a few stars if you're so inclined.
Spokes is produced by Colette Colfer and Terry Hackett.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.